Today, what Britain's worst mass shooting in over a decade tells us about the dark online world of incels. And just a warning before we start, we do talk about misogynist violence and make reference to suicide in this episode. It began last Thursday evening, just after 6 p.m. The gunman entered a house on Biddick Drive, a quiet street in Plymouth, close to the city's dockyard. In that house, he shot his mother, Maxine Davison. He then went outside and killed Lee Martin and his daughter, Sophie. She was 3 years old. He injured two others and then went on to take the lives of Stephen Washington and Kate Shepherd. In total, the attack lasted for 12 minutes.
A few more details now on the breaking news that we've been bringing you from Plymouth. The emergency services are responding to an incident in the city in Devon. Southwestern Ambulance Service says it has sent four helicopters to the scene in the Keyham area of the city.
Doctors in the following hours, the police classed this as a domestic incident.
Officers said the shootings were not thought to be terror-related. After speaking to the Chief Constable of Devon and Cornwall Police, the Home Secretary Priti Patel said on Twitter that she was shocked by the incident. She urged the community to remain calm.
But then evidence began to emerge about the killer. Jake Davison had been immersed in a misogynist online world known as the incel movement. While his reasons for carrying out the attack are still unknown, his online footprint has left police increasingly concerned that it may have been motivated by a hatred of women.
Keyham community are grieving, but there's a lot of love in this place, and the community spirit here has always been really, really strong.
And I think it's amazing how many people have come out tonight just to pay their respects and show how much love and support is around.
For the tight-knit community where he lived, the connection between a local man and an embittered internet subculture that has been tied to previous acts of mass violence is hard to understand. But those who have spent years examining this movement are asking what his actions tell us about a leaderless ideology that some argue should now be viewed as a terrorist threat. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the story of the incel movement. Florence Keane, you're researching internet subcultures at the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation at King's College London. When you heard about the Plymouth shootings and details about the gunman began to emerge, where did you start looking online for more information?
So we obviously kind of heard the news when everyone else did late on Thursday night. And initially, we know the police were calling it a domestic incident, which they still are. But quite quickly, it then emerged that this shooter had some overlap with various kind of online subcultures. So specifically, he had a YouTube channel where he posted several videos in the kind of weeks and months leading to the shooting, where, you know, much of the language that he was using and the discourse, he really seemed to be interested in these communities and potentially embedded in them. And from there, we managed to establish his Reddit profile, his Instagram accounts and his Facebook, all of which started to paint a bigger picture of someone that was, you know, deeply misogynistic and interested in these kind of online male subcultures.
We should say that police are still investigating this shooting, and it is too early to say what his motivations were. But when you look at the kind of views he was sharing online, the kind of videos he was making, did what he say remind you of other content that you look at in your work?
Yeah, what we saw with Davison, and as you say, we still don't know the motivation, but the kind of things he was saying really painted a picture of someone with a deep amount of grievances against the world that overlap with the incel subculture. It was this notion that, you know, he was almost 23, he was still a virgin, he'd been, you know, trying to improve himself, you know, videos of him kind of working out, saying that, you know, he thought that his life would change and it hadn't. Really paints a picture of someone that was, you know, quite disillusioned with the world. And really landing that blame on women and really kind of using quite dehumanising language for women as a whole, in that, you know, it's really, you know, their fault for being picky. That's why someone like him will never be able to find a relationship. It was kind of a very kind of a grievance filled picture that again, I would say does overlap with some of these online male cultures that I study.
I mean, and just going back a little bit, what do we mean when we say incel? I mean, when did that term first start being used?
So incel, to break it down, stands for involuntary celibate. And of course, you know, the idea of someone being involuntary celibate will have existed for forever, ultimately. It first actually became a term, you know, spanning back about 20 years ago. It started as a forum, ironically, by a woman, actually, a queer woman, who started this forum called Alana's Involuntary Celibate Project.
It was a friendly place to talk about being lonely and wanting human connection and wondering what it is that we were struggling with.
It was initially really a much more open and sympathetic space for, you know, people who were virgins to kind of come together to talk about their anxieties of being like left behind from their peer group.
You know, personal issues and not having enough friends and family issues and all that stuff would all be tied into someone's loneliness and disconnection.
It was much more akin to a self-help community, as you know, than it was anything that was, you know, misogynistic.
And so I'm still interested in working on that issue with people, but we can't call it involuntary celibacy anymore because the, you know, the angry, violent incel people have taken that over, unfortunately.
And how has the incel identity evolved over time? As you said, sort of rooted in this idea of being celibate but not by choice. How has it sort of gone beyond that?
So even within the incel subculture, there are variations of how they would really define themselves. So on the one hand, you may have people that define themselves as incel, but actually they potentially see a way out, and that comes to that idea of being able to like better yourself and improve yourself. It's still deeply misogynistic often, and still maybe describes women in a dehumanizing way, but it potentially sees an end point where you may be able to kind of get out of your circumstance. On the other hand, we see some incels within the community that are much more nihilistic about their outcomes, and they would talk about themselves as being blackpilled. And essentially that means this kind of acceptance that, you know, the system's really gone too far to change. There's nothing that can be done by these incels to raise their status. They believe that they're determined to a life at the bottom of this sort of genetic hierarchy based on looks, and nothing that they can do will achieve that change. And some have argued that, you know, if someone is black-pilled and they buy into that ideology, they're potentially more likely to engage in a more kind of violent worldview, whether that's, you know, talking in a violent way online, whether that's expressing intent in real life, but actually harming themselves as well.
And you mentioned the term black-pilling. What does that mean?
The red pill is probably the most well known, and that's this trope borrowed from the film The Matrix, where there was that famous scene of Neo being offered the red pill or the blue pill. And the red pill means you're being awakened as society, as it really has. And he takes the red pill and he wakes up into the world and he sees the world as it is. So it's basically a metaphor for enlightenment into the world as it actually is. So more generally, in men's rights communities and the manosphere, the red pill is awakening yourself to a life of feminist delusion and saying, like, you know, men are actually victims. And the black pill is this incel iteration of it. So it's not simply that, you know, men have lost power, but it's saying, you know, there is nothing that can be done about this. The system is what it is. I look a lot at the idea of kind of power and this kind of shifting of power. So I guess in like broader male activist communities, there's this idea that, you know, this sort of feminist takeover by the world means that men are now on the bottom. They see themselves as losing power in the real world. And that's why there's this big kind of feminist backlash. And inceldom is really the kind of the bitter end of that. So it's, you know, not simply just about, you know, men's place in the world, but really just what they feel is being denied to them, which is this sort of basic biological right of sex.
So that's blackpilling. And another term I've seen used is Chads and Stacey's. What does that mean?
Yeah, so when incel communities talk about Chads and Stacey's. It's really this notion of the kind of idealised body of a man and a woman who they see as at the top. And you know, the Chad being the man, this kind of very muscular looking man. There's a kind of famous like Chad versus Virgin meme or Chad versus Stacey meme where you have the kind of two bodies side by side. And yeah, as I say, the Chad is this very kind of muscular looking white man. And the Stacey is a very kind of voluptuous blonde woman with, you know, big breasts and kind of all these very looks-based stereotypes, really, that, you know, really sort of show themselves incels seeing themselves as like totally inferior to this like ideal, you know, body type. And some of that crosses over as well into race as well. They often refer to the idea of, you know, just be white, which again is this idea that, you know, the white man is also the kind of idealized way to look. So while sometimes people, you know, often say, you know, incels are far right and they're white supremacist, you know, I would say there are influences of white supremacist ideology, but actually we see really kind of diverse profiles of incels. It's not just white men.
Although it's very diverse, have you found that there is a common incel profile, like a typical kind of person who might be predisposed to follow these ideas?
I mean, it seems to be, you know, relatively young men. It became, I think, really started being bigger in North America. But of course, we do know that there are more and more kind of users in other parts of the world, you know, in the UK, in Europe as well. So a lot of it's anonymous. So people using kind of avatars and hiding their IP addresses. So it's, again, quite difficult to say, you know, it's this average age in this specific place. But generally kind of young men, maybe as they go into their 20s as well, and even potentially older, who have found they're kind of unable to form relationships. Again, you know, there's debates online about what constitutes a real incel. You know, some people call themselves, you know, true cells. You know, they're kind of pure virgins. They've never kissed a woman. They've never spoken to a woman. Some men may have had a relationship, but they haven't had one for a long time. Some incels are referred to as fake cells, which is actually this kind of debate over whether someone is too good looking to be a true incel. So often individuals will post a picture of themselves and ask what the community think. And they might say, you know, you're too good looking actually to be an incel. You know, you could easily get a girl.
How does incel culture compare to other online subcultures, do you think, in terms of how people are radicalised?
What is slightly different about the incel culture, if we think about other potentially extreme movements, is there's a kind of duality in that they really see themselves as inferior in terms of their looks, but they see themselves as kind of superior in their intellect, whereas other extremists, maybe, you know, in the alt-right or, you know, in other spaces, it's not confined to the right wing either. When they're considering themselves as they're the kind of core in-group, it's really that they're better than those that they hate. Whereas with incels, it's that they hate their out-group, but they also feel inferior to them. And I think that's where the incel movement is quite different. And, you know, people, you know, compare incels and say, you know, do we need to treat it like we treated, you know, another terrorist group, for example, Al-Qaeda or ISIS or something like that. And it's really difficult with the incel movement because, you know, there is no one fixed doctrine. There is no leader. There's no core text and there's no real end goal either. And, you know, there's no kind of belief in a kind of higher power afterwards. It is quite different.
Okay, so you've told us about the patterns you see within incel culture. Tell me about when it shifted from online forums to something with real-world consequences.
Really, the word incel came into public consciousness in 2014 when a 22-year-old man named Elliot Roger took a mass killing spree in Isla Vista, California. He began by stabbing his two housemates and another man in his own apartment. And then he attempted to break into a sorority house at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He failed to get in, and then he just started to randomly shoot passers-by.
CNN has learned Elliot Rogers' father was racing from L.A. to Santa Barbara in a frantic search for his son when the car radio blurted an announcement.
Witness, it was a four-colored BMW one occupant, a male wearing a white shirt.
Someone driving a black BMW, just like his son's, was on a deadly shooting rampage in Santa Barbara.
And then after exchanging some gunfire with police, he then died from a self-inflicted wound. So that was really when this first case came into our understanding. And he left this huge manifesto called My Twisted World, which was 137 pages long. It was this kind of autobiographical account where he really deeply lamented his frustrations over his failure to form relationships with women and have sex. And then within that, had this real kind of detailed plan of his day of retribution, where he noted that his ultimate goal was to murder as many women as possible in this sorority house. After that, police uncovered he'd really been planning this attack for months and had uploaded several kind of YouTube videos before that were quite disturbing.
I mean, it's such a horrific case. What was the response on incel forums to this?
Elliot Rodger plays a pretty important role in the incel community, kind of hailed as the first sort of incel hero, I suppose. And when another attack happens that, you know, may or may not be incel or misogynist, people often say, you know, he's gone ER to stand for Elliot Rodger's initials. Alec Manassian, who was the Toronto van attacker several years later in 2018, had posted before, you know, all hail the incel rebellion.
As police search for a motive, one possible explanation is circulating online, suggesting Manassian was angry over being rebuffed by women. In what appears to be a post on Facebook, in which a man with the same name and picture as Manassian refers to the supreme gentleman, Elliot Rodger.
Just as we might see in other extremist communities, people referencing attackers from before, we do see a similar thing at play with the violent kind of incel attacks that we have seen. You know, I would stress it's still a handful of cases, maybe if we compared it to what we've seen on the far right in recent years, and of course some of the kind of jihadist violence that we've seen. But nonetheless, there is this kind of self-referential nature of some of the attacks, and Elliot Rodger forms a core part of that.
Before the Plymouth shootings, have there been any cases of known incels carrying out attacks in the UK?
So there's two quite interesting cases that we've seen in the last year. So two terror trials, one in Scotland and one in Middlesbrough. And both defendants were young men, and they were both charged on terrorism charges. The incel subculture was referenced in both of the trials, but ultimately it wasn't part of the final conviction. But definitely interesting to note how there may have been some overlap there as well.
Is this something then that is becoming better understood here in the UK? I mean, are police taking incel culture more seriously?
I believe the understanding is growing. It was interesting to see Jonathan Hall QC's comments over the weekend. He's the UK independent reviewer of terrorism legislation.
...stated incident where someone's got a very obscure ideology that leads them to go and kill someone. It would in principle qualify as terrorism. Would you want to divert resources and treat it as terrorism? Probably not. If something reaches a scale where it affects, if you like, the national security of the country or the general sense of security of the population, then you might want to. And there have always been these quite difficult balancing exercises.
He goes into a lot of detail about inceldom in one of his core documents and really kind of confirms that, you know, inceldom can, in some cases, be treated as an ideology for the purposes of terrorism. The Canadian government, you know, are really interesting to look at because they've specifically recognised inceldom as a form of ideologically motivated violent extremism. So, you know, it does seem that governments are paying more attention to it and trying to understand how that may fit into our understanding of extremism and potentially even terrorism.
And we should say that in the UK, terrorism can be treated differently to other kinds of violent crime by the police and legal system in terms of investigation and sentencing. But as Jonathan Hall says, not all incel-inspired violence would automatically be an act of terrorism. It would have to be carried out with the intention of actually furthering this cause. Do you think there are cases where incel violence has that kind of motivation?
So there's certainly grounds for this. So it's not to say that the whole subculture should be treated as a terrorist community. But I think there is a growing notion that on an individual basis, if we can see that there's a kind of ideological or political motive for an attack that could be connected to the subculture, then there would be grounds to look at it as a terrorist charge. And what I would say is that the main way that people are going to understand these cultures is really by spending time in the weeds of it, understanding the codes, understanding the memes, because you could easily, you know, look at the news this weekend and think this is the next big threat and we should be scared. And I probably wouldn't say that, certainly not yet, but definitely the more understanding that governments and police forces have about how these sort of subcultures speak to each other, I think is important.
Coming up, following investigations into the Plymouth gunman, Devon and Cornwall police consider reclassifying last week's shootings as an act of terrorism. Florence, at the moment, the Plymouth case is not being treated as terrorism, although it may be reclassified, according to police. Is it important that we classify this as terrorism or not?
I think there could be grounds for it. Obviously, you know, there's a very specific UK definition of terrorism, which stipulates that it must be for the purpose of advancing a political, a racial, a religious or an ideological cause. I don't see why on an individual case this, if it's proven that there is that ideological motivation behind it, if it's proven that the time that was spent in a subculture has radicalised an individual to express a violent, misogynistic rage against women, and then they go and enact that violent fantasy, that to me would meet the definition of terrorism. So it's all really about establishing motivation and purpose.
Another issue now under scrutiny in the Plymouth case is the fact the killer had his gun licence restored after attending an anger management course, a decision which is now under investigation by the Independent Office for Police Conduct. And this week, in response to this, ministers have said that going forward, applicants for permission to own firearms will have their social media checked. Do you have a sense that police and security services are doing enough to try to root out people online who might go on to commit these kinds of crimes or have these sort of extreme views?
It's difficult. It can be very easy to immediately blame tech companies and the police for missing things, which, you know, is not to say we shouldn't scrutinise what they do in relation to particular crimes and particularly before something has happened. But if, you know, the threshold for violence isn't seen, and if it's not expressed beforehand, it can be often very, very difficult to flag. But I think, you know, questions do need to be asked about why Davison's licence was removed, which would indicate there was an issue there and there was an anger management class attended, and then why it was given back. So perhaps this is an example where, had his social media been scrutinised a bit further, the fact that, you know, we know that via his YouTube, for example, he had an interest in gun culture, perhaps there would be grounds for saying, you know, is this someone that should own a gun? But, you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing, and piecing the picture afterwards, it's very easy to say, well, of course he shouldn't have had a gun. But beforehand, it's difficult.
Florence, a lot of what we've talked about in this episode might feel like new information for many people, and the incel movement is still fairly unknown to most, but it's clearly growing and, as you've explained, needs to be better understood. But is this word incel really something we haven't seen before? Is it just a recent term for problems and attitudes that have been around for hundreds of years?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It's something I think about a lot. I mean, the simple fact of someone being a virgin and being frustrated with that, I mean, that arguably is probably something that's timeless across society. So is it that, you know, incels have always existed, but the online world has essentially given them a place to congregate? But I think we can't overlook the fact that the internet has created something quite specific, because, you know, without the internet, yes, people may have been virgins and they may have been frustrated, but they wouldn't have had a place to share their grievances and create this kind of language and this kind of social hierarchy that many of them believe in very fundamentally. And I think that's what's different now. It's really the fact that we have online subcultures that kind of foment and potentially push some into a bit more of an extremist mindset. Whereas, of course, you may have had men and women who were lonely and who were virgins and who were sad about that, but they didn't necessarily have a tangible community in which to congregate.
Florence, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Florence Keane. As this story develops, our team of reporters are continuing to bring you the latest from Plymouth. Follow their work at theguardian.com. And also read more on the incel movement at the website, including an article by Laura Bates called "The Incel Movement is a Form of Extremism and It Cannot Be Ignored Any Longer." If you've been affected by anything we've talked about in this episode, you can contact Samaritans on 116 123 or you can email joe@samaritans.org. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.